Good morning. We're going to go to Daniel for the next few weeks. I can't think of a better book for us to go to as we continue to navigate our way through stuff that we find in our lives. Before we do, though, I got a text last night from Dwayne Nishimoto. So Dwayne and all others again watching this morning, welcome and hello. Dwayne let me know that there are some Valentines that are in the church office, and if you want to go get one, they're small little Valentines. You know, we've been cleaning out our garage, and I'm finding all kinds. You know, you have to go through these boxes, and each box has about 99.9% of the stuff is just throw it away, but the other 0.5% of the stuff is priceless stuff that you never want to throw away. And one of the things I came, you know, that we didn't throw much away. That's our problem right now. And so I came across, you know, our girls' stuff for when they were in elementary school. And one of them had this thing they did. I don't know, she was in second grade or something. Just a whole thing full of little Valentines that she got in her classroom. And so I said, so anyway, I'm going to cry now. So if you want to go back and pick up some Valentine's, give to your friends and neighbors, go ahead and do that, and brighten up their week in the name of Jesus. All right, so that's for you there. Now, opposing that or opposite that, over the last 10 months or so, we have lived in a very gray world, haven't we? And sometimes we wonder if it's ever going to be in color again. You know, it's kind of like watching TV in black and white, and then suddenly you're in color. A lot of people have lost hope in our country, in our world, and we wonder what's going on. There's a level of despair that we perhaps haven't seen ever in our lifetimes, at least those of us who have lived a little bit of life. A lot of bad news going on in the world. We worry about our children. Having grandchildren now, we worry about what kind of world our grandchildren are going to be growing up in. So there's plenty to make us depressed, isn't there? Again, first message I ever gave here at Magnolia, I told that's why I don't watch the news, because I don't want to go to bed mad or depressed. So we don't. In his book, The Knowledge of the Holy, great devotional book, classic by A.W. Tozer, he discusses the fact that God is in control, and yet he allows us an awful lot of what we would call free will as we move on in life. And he likens it like this, as he tries to put those two concepts together. He says, it's kind of like this. An ocean liner leaves New York and is bound for Liverpool. The destination has been determined by the proper authorities. It's going to Liverpool, and it's not going to deviate. That's where it's going. Nothing can change that. And there is that's a little bit of the picture of the sovereignty of God in terms of how the world is unfolding, how history is unfolding before us. God has a predetermined destination for humanity, for you and I. And we're going there. We're on the ship. We can't get off. The ship is going. It's left the port. That ship has sailed. And we're on it. Now, while we're on the ship, we can do a lot of stuff that we want, right? We can have fun. Now, the problem is some people know it's going to Liverpool. Other people think it's going somewhere else. So it's a good idea to know where the ship is going. And that's where faith comes in, of course. But we get to do an awful lot of what we want to do while we're on the ship, but it's heading to Liverpool. Well, in Daniel, we see a God who, despite all appearances, is in charge. He knows where the ship, he's determined where the course of humanity is going. So we're just going to unfold Daniel a little bit as a whole. An uncompromising man with uncompromising faith is the title of the series that we're doing in Daniel. So here's what the message is about today. We want to give a background. Now that cheers your soul, doesn't it? Oh good, we get to do a background of the book of Daniel. Bill Hatch out told me before the service, boy, you better be good today. So, Bill, I don't know if this is going to be one of those that, you know, is going to do your heart great. But, you know, I'll do the best I can. But we are going to do a background on the book of Daniel. We're going to explore some of the important themes. So the first part of the message is kind of for your head. So just turn your brains on a little bit. And then the second part, hopefully, will hit a little bit deeper as we look at some of the themes of Daniel that we'll be covering in the next weeks. It's one of the most fascinating books in all of the Bible. It reveals God's plans and his sovereignty for the unfolding of human history and also for Israel's place in that history. It's a key to understanding the prophecies of Jesus from Matthew 24 and 25 and the prophecies of Revelation. And so it is a key prophetic book, but there's a lot more going on than just that. Now, here's what we're trying to accomplish today. The purpose of the message is to contemplate the amazing power, the mercy, and the grace of God so that our faith in him will be encouraged during these times of uncertainty. So let's go back to where we've been the last 4 weeks. God is great, therefore we do not... I failed as a teacher. We do not have to be in control. God's got things handled just fine without us. He can handle the course of human history. He is great. He's massive. He spans the heavens like this. We look up and it's vast to him. So he's massive. He's great. He is also glorious. Therefore, we do not have to be afraid. Fear. We don't have to fear people. God is great. God is glorious. And if we truly get a vision of him like Isaiah did in the temple in Isaiah chapter 6, then we're never going to be afraid of any person ever again. God is glorious. And when we see him, we truly, having a little bit of fear is a good idea in front of that kind of a being. If he were only great and glorious, that might be bad news for us because he could do some really nasty things to us very easily. But he is also good. Therefore, we do not need to look elsewhere. He is good. He has good planned for those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. He works all things, even the bad, out together for good. And then finally, he is gracious. He wants to forgive us more than we want to be forgiven. He is gracious. Therefore, we do not need to prove ourselves to him all the time. He's already forgiven us. We can just relax and carry on and serve him as he wants us to. All right, so Daniel, we're going to see all of those. We're going to see God's greatness. We're going to see his gloriousness. We are going to see his goodness. We're going to see his graciousness as we move on. There's a key verse to Daniel. I mean, there's a lot of verses, but here is a key passage. It's in Daniel chapter 2. If you're familiar with Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar had a bad dream, didn't know what it meant, none of his wise men could figure out what it meant, and he wasn't going to tell them the dream because he didn't quite trust them. He thought they might lie to him, and so he's going to have them all killed. Daniel happened to be a wise man at this time. That was bad news for him, and he says, wait a minute, can you give me a little bit of time? He prays, and God reveals the dream to him and the interpretation. So as Daniel is thanking God for that, he says this, Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. That's a key passage in the book of Daniel to understand what's going on here. It is really not so much a book about Daniel or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or about Nebuchadnezzar, or about Belshazzar, or about Cyrus, or about Darius, or any of those other leaders or kings or servants of the Lord. It is about the Lord himself. It is about God. It is about the one who is directing human events to a predetermined place, and he is going to be seen as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and he shall reign forever and ever. That is an important message in Daniel. Why? What do you know about what was happening to the Jews during this time? Class, it's okay to speak up. What was happening with them? Exile, all right? Not only exile, but the temple, the dwelling place of God, leveled to the ground, destroyed. So you think things seem hopeless to you now. They really seemed hopeless to people in those days, to the Jewish people particularly. To Daniel, who was, as you're going to find out, only 15 when he was deported from his hometown to a very strange place. And God remained active. By all intents and purposes, he wasn't around anymore, but he showed that he very much was. So we're going to look at that as we go to Daniel. First, we're going to look at Daniel's place in history. And so those of you taking notes, Daniel's place in Israel history, he lived and wrote during the Babylonian captivity of 605 B.C. through roughly 538 B.C. You'll go home and curl up by the fire with that one tonight, I know. So, there were a series of empires that happened. Before Babylon, there was the Assyrian Empire. So, on your notes are some of these things right here. So, going back to 1040 B.C., the nation of Israel was united under Saul and then David and Solomon. And then it was divided between 960 and 606, but actually in 720, the northern kingdom of Israel was taken into exile by the Assyrians. And then beginning in 605, and there I believe there were three deportations of Jewish people. One happened in 605, another one about 10 years later, 596, and then finally in 586, when Nebuchadnezzar just got fed up to hear with the Jewish rebels, he tore the whole thing down. Jerusalem destroyed, the temple destroyed. And so then after the Babylonian Empire, though, came the Medes and the Persian Empire, and then came the Greek Empire under Alexander the Great, and finally the Roman Empire. Daniel's going to write about all of those as God gives him vision. This is the part of the world that where all of this takes place. Nothing going on in this part of the world these days, is there? So there it is, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Jordan, Israel. So all of that part of the world is where things are taking place. The Babylonian part, the Babylonian capital was Babylon down there in what's southern Iraq now. The Assyrian capital was up in Nineveh, so it just moved south, and you see Tyre to the right, or to the left over there. The Babylonian Empire is in red here. The Persian Empire, as you can see, went a lot bigger than even the Babylonian Empire. And then the Greeks, Alexander the Great, in just a small amount of time, took that over, and then he died. We're going to see all of these things prophesied by Daniel in the second part of the book. So who was Daniel? Well, his name, and there it is in Hebrew for you people who love sort of things like that, his name means God is my judge. And Daniel was of noble descent. I know I'm going too fast, so back to the other one. God is my judge is the fill-in. And then he was of noble descent. That meant he was kind of royalty in Israel. He was not a peasant. He was not a farmer trying to scrape out a living. He was born in Jerusalem, and he was in the nobility. He was an up-and-comer in Jerusalem. He was part of the aristocracy, as it were. So that's who he was. He was only about 15 years old, we think, when he was deported to Babylon. So imagine yourself being Daniel, 15-year-old. What were you doing at 15? All I cared about at 15 was baseball, pretty much. I mean, I had to work. My dad had a gardening business. I had to go out there and mow lawns. But really, what I wanted to do was be playing baseball. And I was going to school. But really, all I wanted to do was play baseball. So that was me at 15. If I had been deported to some other land where baseball didn't exist, I don't know what I would have done. I'd have been pretty sad. So there's Daniel, taken as a 15-year-old boy from Jerusalem to Babylon. Now again, he was part of the aristocracy. He had some wealth, and he lost it all, and he was forced to go into Babylon. No indication of whether his family went with him. We think not. Just took some of the young men, and they were going to train them up in the ways of the Babylonians. As I already said, there were three deportations of Jewish people. Daniel was probably among the first in 605. The temple had not yet been destroyed. That would happen about 20 years later. So at the age of 35, Daniel, who had been in Babylon now for 20 years, saw whatever hope they had of Israel or of Judah becoming, tearing off the shackles of the Babylonians, died as the temple and everything else was destroyed. He was also a man of great faith, as we're going to see as we move. It never wavered. There are some certain examples in Daniel chapter 1. Daniel and his three friends were called to into the Babylonian court, and they were going to feed them all the Babylonian food, some of which I'm sure involved pork and shellfish. To Jewish people, you're not supposed to eat that. And it said Daniel determined he was not going to defile himself with the king's food. And no matter what, now Daniel was very creative in how he worked this out, as we're going to see when we get to chapter 1. But come what may, he was determined, I'm not going to eat it. I'm a child of God. I'm Jewish. I don't eat that stuff. And so he didn't. And God sustained him. In chapter 2, when Daniel was called before Nebuchadnezzar because he had the interpretation of the dream, he told Nebuchadnezzar this, look, and again, he's young. I mean, it's maybe 16, 17 at this point, before the most powerful man on the face of the earth. God had given Daniel a revelation, and he said this, look, king, no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. 17 years old or so before the king. In Daniel chapter 6, he was an old man now, and Daniel chapter 6 is the lion's den. So you know the story. He had some jealous co-workers who wanted him done. And so they did him in with his own faith, with his own practice. They knew Daniel prayed every day, so they went to the king and said, hey, how about making a decree that nobody can ask anybody for anything, no God or anybody else except you, for the next however many days? The king said, sounds like a good idea to me, because the king didn't think a whole lot. He loved Daniel. And then in chapter 6 it says this, and this is brilliant. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed. In other words, he heard, okay, the king signed. It's almost like he was waiting for the king to sign this ridiculous decree. And so when he knew it had been signed, what did he do? He went to his house where he had windows in the upper chamber, opened them up, got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks just as he had done previously. I don't care about your stinking decree. I'm going to keep praying. Doesn't matter. He was a man of faith. In Daniel chapter 9, we have a great prayer of repentance that Daniel made before God, because he recognized that the 70 years that had been prophesied about the captivity was just about up. And rather than presume upon God, saying, okay, God, 70 years is about up. How about it? Let's go. Come on. Chop, chop. Let's get things going. Time's up. Instead of that, he does this. Then I turned my face to the Lord God, seeking him by prayer and pleas for mercy with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession, saying, O Lord, the great and awesome God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, we have sinned and done wrong and acted wickedly and rebelled, turning aside from your commandments and your rules. This was a humble man of faith. He did not presume upon God, even when he knew God had made a promise. Fascinating. He was also chosen by God for really important work. One of the things was that he was going to maintain the honor of the true God, Yahweh, in a pagan land, in Babylon. He was also there by God's decree to enhance the welfare of the Jews who were living in captivity. It's a lot of parallels with Joseph, with Daniel, both taken against their will into a foreign land, both rising to heights of great power in that foreign land. Daniel rising to power not only with the Babylonian Empire, but later on with the Persian Empire. Two empires. Daniel saw them come and go. It was hard to scare him because he knew his God, and he was there to enhance the welfare. Now, the contents of Daniel, there are 6 chapters of narrative or story. And then there's 6 chapters of prophetic and apocalyptic literature. Ooh, apocalyptic, that's a good word. It just means to unveil something. And so Daniel's going to get a lot of visions. He's going to see a lot that God allows him to see that has to do with the near future and also the distant future. But there's another way to divide the book, because it was written in 2 different languages. It was written in Hebrew, as the rest of the Old Testament was, but also in Aramaic, which was the lingua franca of the day. In other words, it was kind of like English today. You go to most countries, and there's a lot of people at least understand English. Well, that was Aramaic. And one of the reasons that most scholars believe, and I do too, is that the portions that are written in Hebrew is addressed specifically, or not only, but specifically to Jewish people. The part written in Aramaic is addressed specifically to Gentile people and kind of unfolds what's happening in the Gentile world, or to use Jesus' words, the times of the Gentiles are unfolded. And that portion is written in Aramaic. It's almost like Daniel. It was like the first Bible translation. If you want to put it this way, they wanted it in a language that people could read. Not everybody could read Hebrew. Although Wycliffe Sue is smiling because she loves Wycliffe, right? So it was written in a language they could understand. And then it was back to Hebrew as it dealt with Israel more. So that's what's happening in the book of Daniel. It's written in Hebrew throughout the first chapter, and then starting at verse 5 in chapter 2, it goes to Aramaic. It stays Aramaic until we get to chapter 8 when it goes back to Hebrew. So chapters 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 are again written in Hebrew. All right, now, Daniel was written, I believe, in the 6th century B.C. In other words, the 500s B.C.s. Now, a lot of scholars believe that Daniel was written in the 2nd century or the 100s B.C.s. Why do they think that? Well, they think that because there are some unbelievable prophecies about some people who are easily identified in history, one of which was a Greek ruler named Antiochus Epiphanes. And so the scholars do not believe that Daniel could have written about those guys 400 years before they were around. And so they choose a later date. I believe that Daniel is a unified work written in the 6th century for a lot of reasons. First of all, there's internal evidence. That means that within the book itself, it says when it was written. So in chapter 8, it says in the third year of King Belshazzar, so that's when Daniel said he got the vision. In chapter 9, it says in the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, I can never say his name properly, who was by descent a Mede, so it gives a date there, third year of Darius. In Daniel chapter 10, it talks about the third year of Cyrus the king. So internally, there are some dates given. This is when I got this vision and I started to write about it, and all of those are 6th century dates. Also, the author of Daniel, which I believe is Daniel himself, shows remarkable knowledge of Babylonian and Persian history, which you would expect from somebody writing when Daniel wrote in the 6th century. Nebuchadnezzar is presented accurately throughout. From what we know of history of Nebuchadnezzar, we get a lot from Daniel. Belshazzar is set forth as a co-ruler in Babylon in chapter 5, the handwriting on the wall chapter, something that was only discovered recently in archaeology. There were a lot of people who thought that Daniel had made mistakes when it listed Belshazzar as king, because we know the last king of the Babylon Empire was a guy named Nabonidus. Isn't this thrilling to you? All right, hang in there. It's going to get better, okay? But you got to know this stuff. His dad, Belshazzar's dad, Nabonidus, was the last king of Babylon, and so the scholars thought, well, who's Belshazzar? Well, it turns out Belshazzar existed because they found something with his name on it. It's kind of like, you know, they found something with Pilate's name on it in Caesarea. Almost as like Pilate was here, and that's kind of what they found with Belshazzar. So we know that Daniel was correct about him. In chapter 6, Darius is presented as a ruler of Babylon, even though Cyrus was the supreme ruler of the Persian Empire. We now know that a guy was appointed who we believe to be Darius to the Babylonian part, as you saw earlier, the larger Persian Empire. It could be that it's referring to Cyrus. It's hard to know that. It also shows that there was flexibility with Babylonian rules based upon Nebuchadnezzar's mood at the time. So Nebuchadnezzar could do something. He could say something. We're going to do this. And then later on, after he cooled off, he would change his mind. And that's kind of how Babylonian rule went. When we get to the Medes and the Persians, there's this thing you've heard, it's a law of the Medes and the Persians, it cannot be changed. Well, that's kind of how they worked. And so you have the Persian guy signing a decree, and when he wanted to change his mind because he realized he had put Daniel in danger by his decree, he couldn't change it. And his officers reminded him, this is the law of the Medes and Persians, you cannot change. Nebuchadnezzar would have just had the guys killed and torn their houses down. But the Persian guy couldn't do that. Okay, they were more a society of law. So that Daniel accurately reflects those differences between Babylonian law and Persian law. There are also manuscripts of the book of Daniel found in Qumran. Anybody who knows what Qumran is? If you've been to Israel, you know what it is. It's a series of caves near the Dead Sea that in 1947 of our era, a little Bedouin shepherd boy was throwing rocks and he heard some things breaking inside these caves. And it turned out to be clay jars with these ancient scrolls in them, mostly biblical material. And Daniel was among the books they found. Almost the whole book of Daniel is one of the things they found in there. Now, this is important to us because these scrolls date from the, guess what, 2nd century B.C. So those who believe Daniel was written in the 2nd century B.C. would have us believe that Daniel was written early in the 2nd century B.C., and then by the time these scrolls were written, it had already become an established thing that these guys were reading in the Dead Sea area of Israel. So it's evidence that Daniel was written early, because already, and it's almost the whole book is found there, and so that is compelling evidence for a 6th century date. Also, there's a unified theme that goes throughout Daniel. The supremacy of God over all earthly kings and kingdoms is a clear theme, and it goes throughout, even through the narratives and then through the prophetic material. And then Jesus quoted Daniel in Matthew chapter 24, 15. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel, so Jesus thought Daniel wrote. And so when Jesus quotes something, it's pretty good for us to take notice that he believed in the authenticity of it, and he quoted Daniel and as he's making his prophecies. And then finally, Daniel is mentioned by the prophet Ezekiel, actually three times in Ezekiel. Ezekiel wrote just after the 6th century during the restoration of Judah, and he mentions Daniel. So those are some reasons. All right, I'm going to go really fast through this because I want to get to the archaeology in Daniel. There's a few things that you ought to know about. This is called the Cyrus Cylinder. It's a document that was issued by Cyrus the Great, and this is how they wrote it on cylinders, and that's how they did it because they could get more on it than just a flat piece of rock. That was discovered in 1879. It was created in about 539 BC by Cyrus the Great when he took Babylon from Nabonidus, and so it just basically is brags about it. That's what that's what a lot of these things do. I'm great. They are little insignificant people. That's kind of how these things go. All right. Another cylinder is the Nabonidus cylinder, who was the father of Belshazzar. He was the final king of Babylon, and so he had a cylinder too. It's noteworthy. It states, as for me, Nabonidus, king of Babylon, save me from sinning against your great... It's written to a god. All right. And it also mentions Belshazzar, his eldest son. There's also the Chronicles of Nabonidus, not the Chronicles of Narnia, but of Nabonidus that he wrote, and we know about those too. And then there's another cylinder, the Nebuchadnezzar cylinder. It's a clay cylinder. All of these were kind of discovered around the turn of the 20th century. It talks about rebuilding a temple. Then again, the Dead Sea Scrolls, as I mentioned, were found in these caves around the Dead Sea. The area, do you see the Dead Sea there? It's just to the left of the Dead Sea. In the very hill country, there's me with my big brother John at Qumran in 2013. Chance I got to go to is just to prove that I've been there. All right, and then this is they're very small Dead Sea Scrolls. So there's a whole museum in Israel where you can go see them. Very often they make road trips. The most recent I think was in 2015. They had some of the Dead Sea Scrolls in L.A. It's a significant archaeological find, and again, nearly the whole book of Daniel is one of the books that they found there. And then there's all kinds of excavations. That's a Dead Sea Scroll there. All kinds of excavations. This is the Ishtar Gate of Babylon that they found and redid, and is there today. I think you can go to, I think it's in the British Museum. I may be wrong about that. Anyway, it's the original bricks. It's quite something. And so when we get to chapter 4 where Nebuchadnezzar is bragging about how great he is and what a great thing he's done by building up Babylon, that's one of the things where we can say, yeah, that's pretty cool. And then there's this other thing called the Nebuchadnezzar brick. They found these all over the country of Iraq. It has his name on it. It's kind of like, this is property of Nebuchadnezzar, so don't mess with it. And they're all over the place. It kind of denotes boundaries and things like that. And then there's also this tablet that talks about the conditions of the Jewish people who were deported into Babylon. And then excavations of Jerusalem itself, they found burn layers from when the Babylonians took over and burned the whole thing down. And then they've also found in those burn layers pottery that is stamped with a rosette, if I can get there, which was, you can't see it in the picture, unfortunately, but it was very common during the era when Babylon was dominating, and those are found in the same areas of the burn layer. So all of that, just to let you know, this isn't fantasy we're talking about. This is real stuff. The Bible exists, and the Bible was written in times and places that existed. It's not fairy tales. It is not. It's not something that somebody has dreamed up one day. This was written in that part of the world at a time that was very dark in Israel history. So let's look at some of the themes of Daniel, and this is really where we want to spend the rest of the time that's almost out now. So here we go. First of all, God is sovereign. God is sovereign over human history. Three verses that I want to look at you. Daniel 4, 34b through 35. I bless the Most High and praised and honored him. And this is Nebuchadnezzar writing, who lives forever and ever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? This is Nebuchadnezzar writing this. And most of you know the context. He started bragging about how great he was, and he'd had a dream, and Daniel said, you know, please stop bragging about how great you are. And Nebuchadnezzar didn't, and he became insane for 7 years. When his sanity came back to him, this is what he wrote. He finally understood who God was and who he was. God is great. God is massive. God is glorious. More glorious and more great than I am. That is something for a Middle Eastern ruler of that era to admit. And Nebuchadnezzar did. To be sovereign, of course, means you answer to no one and you do what you want. God has willed the course of human events, and he has the power to pull it off, even when his people are in exile, even when his temple has been destroyed. That doesn't change who he is. Things looked bad for Daniel when he and his friends were taken to live in Babylon. Things got worse in 586 when the temple was destroyed. That may be bad enough, but in those days, when one nation overcame another nation, it was thought by all that the gods of the nation who won were tougher and bigger and badder than the gods of the nation who lost. Therefore, if Babylon has taken over Judah, well, that means that Marduk or Bel or Nabu is greater than Yahweh. Or so they thought. They found out that God is the God of human history. You know what? It might feel to you like God is lost today, like the culture war that God's lost. He's lost to secularism. He's lost to the intelligentsia of the day. We can never, quote, have the influence that we've had in the past. God's lost. We've lost. Well, God doesn't really set it up, win and lose, in this way. He is controlling human history. The message of Daniel is that God is too massive to ever be eclipsed by anyone. He will do what he has determined to do, no matter what king is in charge. He sets them up and he takes them down. We ought to grab onto that. If there is a ruler, he or she is there because God has allowed him to be there. And in some cases, God has purposely put rulers in charge to do what he wants. He calls Cyrus, the great Persian, the first Persian ruler, is called in the book of Isaiah, 200 years before he was around, God calls him my servant Cyrus. As far as I know, Cyrus was not a believer in the God of Israel. He's a nicer ruler than most. but he's called my servant. These people who may be acting in what they think is their power, is that they are actually dependent upon God for their very power. Next theme, God has not forgotten. Let me go back to it. God has not forgotten his covenant people. He is faithful and gracious to them, even when they are under discipline. He has not forgotten his covenant people. He is faithful and gracious to them, even while they are under discipline. In Daniel chapter 9, I already referred to it, the great prayer of Daniel. It says this, in the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, by descent a Mede, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, perceived in the books the number of years that according to the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet must pass before the end of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. Then I turned my face to the Lord God, seeking him by prayer and pleas for mercy with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession, saying, O Lord, the great and awesome God, who keeps the covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. Again, this is a great prayer of Daniel before God revealed to him some pretty incredible things. He believed that God was still powerful and God was still sovereign. Many of his fellow Jews had stopped believing that. Daniel never did. You know, some of them maybe thought that God had just had enough of them and was going to move on with things without the Jewish people. Maybe God had finally had enough of their disobedience and their hard-heartedness, and like during the time of Moses, was just ready to forget them. Step aside, Moses, I'm going to kill them all. Don't. You've made promises to them. The great prayer of Moses. And well, in a sense, Daniel's doing the same thing. He's acknowledging that God has made promises, and yet he does it humbly, and he confesses. God has not forgotten his people. The message of Daniel is that he is still with them, and he remembered all of the promises that he had made to them, and he would fulfill them. Not one of them would go unfulfilled. I don't know about you, but maybe you feel sometimes that God does not notice you. Maybe you feel like a very small person living in obscurity on a small planet that's in a vast universe. You ever feel like that? How and why should God pay any attention to me, to you? You may be comforted to know that David felt like this. In Psalm 113:1, he writes, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever?" Feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? How long will you hide your face from me? David felt like that quite a bit, and he just offered these prayers to God. That's what a lot of the Jewish people were thinking and feeling then. But Isaiah the prophet writes this in Isaiah 49:5. "Can a woman forget her nursing child, that she should have no compassion on the son of her womb? Even these may forget, but I will never forget you." The irony, of course, is that we forget God more often than he ever forgets us. He doesn't forget us. He is with us. It's a rhetorical question. Of course, a woman can't forget her nursing child. God will not forget you, who is called according to his purpose. Another theme, God is worthy of trust and faithful obedience. I'm just from Daniel chapter 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had a difficult choice to make. Would they bow down before the image, which I think was an image of Nebuchadnezzar, or would they stay faithful to God? Chapter 3, verses 16 through 17. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king. And I love this. "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." Nebuchadnezzar was hot, and he was about to throw them into someplace a lot hotter. "If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. You know what happened. God did deliver them. Daniel chapter 6. Again, I read this one. Daniel knew the document had been signed. He threw open his windows in his upper chamber and prayed towards Jerusalem, got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed, as he had done previously. One of the many themes in the messages of Daniel is that God is worthy of our obedience. And the more difficult it is to obey him, the more God is seen to reward the people who have that kind of faith in him. Chapter 1, Daniel resolved. He determined he would not defile himself with the king's food. God brought a way for him to do that, to not defile himself. Chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to worship the image of Nebuchadnezzar at the risk of a horrible death. God delivered them. Chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar himself decided not to obey God and found out what the consequences of that were. It didn't work so well for him. Chapter 6, Daniel keeps praying despite the plot against him and by some very vicious co-workers. He kept praying to God, and the text is clear that he did it on purpose after he heard the edict. God is worthy to be obeyed. Now, in the great book of Hebrews in chapter 11, we find out that it doesn't always turn out really well for circumstances in this world. Some people do indeed die. Some people have died for their faith. They are called martyrs. You know what the word martyr means? It's the Greek word for witness. It means witness. And because so many people lost their life for their faith, for their witness, it came to be the same word as dying for your faith. A lot of people have, and yet I'm sure they've found that their trust in God was not disappointed even when they died. These guys were ready to die because God was more important. Obedience to him is right and proper. Finally, it's to reveal his plan for human history. Daniel chapter 2, verses 44 through 45. And in the days of those kings, this is again in context of the prophecy, and that's the toes of the idol. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. And just as you saw a stone that was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. There is a stone cut without hands out of a mountain that came and obliterated the statue which represented all the kingdoms of men up to that point and beyond. The stone cut without hands, Jesus himself, the king, coming to establish his kingdom, which there will be no end, nor will it be turned over. There won't be another empire to succeed him as there have been throughout human history. It's the final kingdom. It's the kingdom where God makes everything right again, where he fulfills his purposes for his creation that he had in the first place. It's wonderful. God loved Daniel and responded to his humility in chapter 9. I think it's no accident that Daniel is called in chapter 9 as the angel comes to him, Daniel, you are greatly loved. And in Revelation, it was written by the apostle who says throughout his gospel, the one who Jesus loved. God made some tremendous revelations to these two humble servants, to Daniel and then later to the apostle John. He is in charge of history. So today, my friends, when you go out from here and all the news is about, well, today it's probably going to be about the Super Bowl. So have some fun frolicking in games for a day. Tomorrow it'll be bad again, I'm telling you. You'll wake up, there will be 20 things that you don't want to hear. And it's all going to be bad news. And it's all going to be, how can we ever get through this? And you're going to hear lots of voices. You're continuing to hear those. And you'll even hear them from people who are, quote, Christian, who have they've kind of given up. Don't give up. God is in control. He is directing the path in the course of human history. He knew that COVID was going to be part of the story before it got here. And he is moving things along as he wills because he's a great and powerful God, but he's also a good God who happens to be a very gracious God and who loves you and who wants you to jump on his team. And he'll take you, as Dr. Seuss says, oh, the places we'll go. And oh, the mindset you will have that is not being controlled by the forces of this world as you encounter all the stuff that you encounter on a daily basis. So here's the next step as the band comes up. This week, just read through Daniel. Take note of the themes and the purpose. 12 chapters. Again, chapter 10 through 12 is, you're going to struggle. But read through the book. Take note of the themes and the purpose. Listen for God. I hope you're developing the habit. And on the discussion questions I have, it always starts with, read this passage. Where did God stop you? That's just a discipline of listening for the voice of God as you read his word. He wants to speak to you. So listen for God's voice as you read. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for Daniel. Thank you that you loved him greatly, and thank you that he remained true to you. But Lord, if we read through Daniel and elevate him as somebody who is kind of a superhero, we've missed the whole picture. He simply did what in his mind was the logical thing to do. He understood you, and he knew who you were. Therefore, he understood that you were great. That you were great, that you were glorious, that you're good, and you are gracious. And so, Lord, may we understand that about you as well. In your name we pray. Amen.